Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the Scary Cast Network. This is Dr. John Stamey welcoming everybody. We've got a jam-packed show tonight on pro wrestling interviews. It's going to be absolutely awesome. I am going to turn over the show right now to the amazing one from Ravenel, South Carolina, the amazing Velvet, who will introduce our two guests. And we're going to have more fun than a barrel of monkeys. And believe me, that was probably not a lot of fun back in Rome. But all right, Velvet, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How about you, Dr. John?
I could not be better because we've truly got one of my favorite wrestlers of all time on here. It is just such a thrill. I'll even say her name, to have the great Susan Green here. She is one of the most incredible people that I have ever met. And you all are going to love what we're writing about her. So, Velvet, the floor is yours.
All right. Since you already introduced Susan Green, what our very special guest tonight, all the way from some asylum deep in the woods. No, I'm just kidding. It's Crazy Train. Crazy Train, how you doing, buddy?
All aboard, ladies and gentlemen. I'm doing good, brother. How you doing?
Man, I'm fine. I was good to talk to you earlier this last week and get catching up a little bit. But so that the folks understand, you know, we're all friends and we all understand each other. We usually start off with, how did you get into this crazy business? You know, when did you want to get into it? And you know, how that all happened?
I moved around a lot as a kid. My dad was an engineer, so he would get sent to different locations when, let's say, they were designing a plant or something to help start up. So we moved around a lot, and I was just very lucky. He's from South Carolina. My mom's from North Carolina. I'm a proud Carolinian, and that's where I call home. I was born in Charleston, but I mean, we moved around all over the place, and it seemed like everywhere we lived, the wrestling territory, yeah, that long ago, when there were actual territories, was
right.
Hot, you know. And I guess my first memories of wrestling would have been the mid-70s in Pampa, Texas, which is just outside of Amarillo. So you're talking the waning days of that territory, you know, right before. I want to think Terry was probably the champ at the time, the world champ at the time. And, you know, Then we lived in Denver for a while when Vern was running Denver on a regular basis. We lived in Louisiana for a while when, by the time that Watts had taken over, you know, the Oklahoma-Louisiana territory. And then we moved back here to the Carolinas and to the upstate in Greenville area in the 80s and right before, you know, the explosion of Crockett, Four Horsemen. Plus, I had an aunt and uncle in Atlanta, which I spent a lot of time with, so I was getting to see the Georgia stuff at the time, Florida, a little bit of Southeastern Continental, you know, because that's close to Knoxville. So I was getting, like, all these territories, and I think I was probably 9 or 10 years old the first time I went to a live show here in Greenville, and I remember the main event was a babyface Briscoe Brothers against Rip Hawk and Sweet Handsome with Playboy Gary Hart as their manager.
Ooh,
so
nice.
I was hooked. I was hooked. And it was
something
I always wanted to do. That's nice. Something I always wanted to do, you know. And it was one of the – it was towards the end of their – of because it was after Flair had already teamed up with, you know, when he had come into the Carolinas and tagged with Rip Hawk. And, you know, he was on to his singles career, feuding with Steamboat and – you know, Blackjack and all them, and they for a short time put Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen back together, and so it was around that time. And it just was always something I wanted to do. I was hooked from that moment on. You know, the bug had bit me. I was always athletically inclined. My mom's family, all athletes. Her older brother was invited to the Falcons training camp when it opened. He played college football and basketball. Her younger brother played college basketball. She turned down a basketball scholarship herself to marry my dad. So my mom's family always had athletic side. My father's side of the family had the entertainment side. His father is kind of a local legend in the Columbia area. He was a jazz musician, played trumpet, and had a had a big band. And so I also have a musical inclination too. I played with him when we moved back here in the 80s as a keyboardist and vocalist and in a jazz combo. So the combination of the two always kind of attracted me. I understood the athletic side of wrestling. I understood the entertainment side of wrestling. And I was probably never good enough to make it as a touring recording musician, and I was never going to be good enough to play in the NFL. So wrestling was kind of the nice blend of the two, and there you go. And I just always wanted to do it. And then just kind of thought it was never going to happen because the territories died as I got to college age. And I went to college and played football and graduated, and then an opportunity came about to where I was able to train locally, and well, the rest is history. And that was back in 94, 95.
Nice.
Hey, Velvet, this is Dr. John. We've got a couple more people that have joined us. First of all,
okay,
we have a very suspicious 910-238 that comes up from Jacksonville, North Carolina, and that must be Todd from Pop Culture Stars. Is that Todd?
Say it ain't so.
I would, but it is. Okay. And we have a new number that I don't know, area code 843-635. Now, who would that be? Hello?
Hello.
It's Ronnie York. It's Ronnie York.
Oh, it's Ronnie York. Never trust a York.
All right, Velvet, you got the floor.
I know
wide open, buddy.
All right. Now, so crazy. I have mm-hmm. another question. Well, first of all, Johnny Ziegler is living in Mexico. Hate to tell you that. Because the last time I talked to him about 2 weeks ago, he was still out of Mexico.
Well, he posted pictures on his Facebook of him in Spartanburg, South Carolina last night, so maybe he got a flight. I don't know.
Okay.
Well, he was low profile.
You better keep that little quiet.
Yeah, you need to keep it quiet. I mean, you know, if FBI or somebody comes after him, I'm blaming you, bro. You're taking the heat for that.
I don't care.
Not me.
I don't care.
Well,
I'm
retired. I'll stooge out somebody now. I don't care anymore.
But anyway, so let me ask you this. Do you still talk to, what's it, was Dr. Feelgood? I don't remember his real name. Do you still talk
to
him?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I had a long-running tag team with Dr. Feelgood off and on for about 10 of the 15 years I was wrestling. And he was living in the Charlotte area, but he's moved down here to the upstate of South Carolina. And
okay, cool.
We talk, the last time we talked was around the holidays, you know. He'll always be one of my closest friends. That's one of the cool things that came out of wrestling was I made some lifelong friends. And
right,
and
it's a shame that we lost touch because we thought that you guys were great, you know. And I know what you said about a particular person. I get that, but I'm hoping we could keep in touch as well. And if you talk to him, tell him we all said hey.
I will.
I
will definitely let him know. I'll give him a call or send a text tomorrow.
Because I thought about when I found you, I would just happen to be scrolling through looking through some old stuff and looking through some old memories and some old phone number stuff. And I came across your name. I said, John Paul, John. I said, hang on a minute. That sounds familiar. So I did some more digging and I put it together. And then I went, wait a minute. I found you on Facebook too. And I was like, oh, crazy train. So,
well, Susan knew how to get a hold of us.
Well, we were. I wasn't thinking about. You know, I just happened to be running across it. But like I said, we were looking for new guests and this and that and people to talk to. I just happened to come across it. It was great. But the thing is, your gimmick was so spot on. Oh my God, being that you were. Go ahead.
Well, funny thing is, Crazy Train was actually my real life nickname. I got given that nickname by the quarterback on my high school football team, my junior year of high school. And you remember the old days of the tape, you know, cassette tape Walkmans? I mean, that long
right.
ago, I would have one in the locker room before games, and I had a mixtape I had made, stuff to get
right.
me pumped up, and I was sitting in my locker, putting my pads in my pants, getting ready for the game, getting there mentally, and I had my headset on, and Travis Moss, our quarterback, walked over, and he's like, you know, give me the little motion to lift my ear up, and so I lift the earphones up, and he's like, what you listening to, Jonathan? I said, Crazy Train, and it just kind of stuck. Because it just happened to be the song that was playing at the time when he asked me.
Very
so
nice.
Awesome.
And, you know,
he
didn't
awesome.
He didn't listen to metal. He was a hip-hop guy, an R&B guy. So he's kind of like, I don't think he knew Ozzy was. And, you know, it just kind of made sense for, you know, just who I was. I mean, I was the fullback. He was the quarterback. We ran, you know, this is in the 80s, so we ran the old power eye.
Right.
And our running back you might have heard of at the time, he was a guy named Brandon Bennett, who went on and played for the University of South Carolina,
yes.
broke some freshman records there, and played about 10 years in the NFL. So the three of us were pretty close. You know, we were the backfield, and it just kind of made sense. I always joke with Brandon whenever I see him. Because when he played at college, you know, he had Robbie DeBoer was the fullback at South Carolina
yep.
at the time. I said,
DeBoer,
you sure like right. us? You sure like us fat white boys being your lead blocker, don't you? And he just chuckles. You know,
that's funny.
But I don't know. When I got into the business, I always thought, well, Crazy Train, that'd be a cool gimmick name, and that shows you how dumb I was thinking that you can just come into the business and pick your gimmick. And you know, not understanding that it picks you more than you pick it, you know.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
But but luckily, you know, I was hell bent to keep that as my gimmick name. And I thought, well, I've got a cool song built in for my entrance music. Once again, not understanding, you don't need to worry about that stuff until you actually know what you're doing.
Right.
But, you know, I was lucky enough early on in my career to meet Buck Forrester and Bill White, who those are names I'm sure some of your listeners might not know. Susan, of course, knows both Buck and Bill.
Oh,
Buck's
yeah.
no longer with
yeah.
us. But both of them being veterans, some of your listeners might know Bill especially because he was kind of a journeyman for the Crockett's in the late 70s. But Bill and Buck kind of saw that I really wanted to do that, and I was trying to heel in my gimmick, and they were just like, "Nah, kid, you're not a heel. You know, you're a baby face. You are, you know." And they were right, and they kind of taught me, you know, gave me a couple ideas on what to do, and I kind of just went from there. And like you have to do in wrestling, on the job training, you know, you learn.
Oh yeah,
work smaller crowds, get better, get booked for bigger crowds, and you know, then I met Susan not long after that, what, about a year or so in my business, into the business, Susan, is that about right?
No, yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, and so Susan really helped polish me up. I'd go down there to Columbia, and she'd work with me some, and I was fortunate enough to meet Wahoo McDaniel, the end of his life around that time, and he kind of took me under his wing, and it was never anything where we really got in the ring. It was more like he had heard the, you know, he had gotten back to him, I believe, I really through Bubba Kirk, who was my trainer.
Yeah.
I got back to him because I played college football, and of course Wahoo did too at Oklahoma, and that was kind of the initial connection, and he found out I liked to golf, I liked to fish, and he would come down here to Greenville and say, hey, I'm going to go hit 18 at Fermi. Want to beat me, kid? And I'm like, oh, heck yeah. So I'd go hit 18 holes with Chief, and you know, I can't say enough. I was very, very lucky early in my career. I was trained by good guys that knew what they were doing, had worked for the office,
right.
and then meeting
right.
people like Susan and Wahoo, you know, that kind of polished me up, made me understand not just what to do, but when to do it, why you should do it, and I guess the rest is history. It must have worked out. I had a decent career, I think.
Yeah, you did. Like I said, I thought the gimmick was spot on, though. I really did. It was great when you were here and seeing you around the state. But when you came down here for a few times, it was pretty cool. It was just like it was. We liked watching it. We liked watching you. You know, we always wanted to see what was going to come out of the bear. We didn't know what you were going to have next in the bear, but that was the thing. Because you would. It was funny. You'd be like, yeah. You seem to tend to, you know, hide stuff and, you know, find, pick things up. That was so funny.
Well,
what are you going to do with the bear?
it was one of those things where, you know, I thought it was just, once again, getting way ahead of myself. Oh, this would be great, you know, to
right.
get something to the ring. And,
right.
you know, that, once again, Buck and Bill, all credit to them, understanding that okay, this could work, but we got to teach the kid how to make it work, you know?
Right,
so
right,
giving
right.
me some ideas. And the bear I had actually was my oldest daughter's. It was one of her. She didn't play with anymore. And
right.
It was one of those teddy bears that had like a vibrator type like heartbeat thing inside it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had died, and I had taken it out. And so it had a zipper compartment on the back of it already built in. And, you know, what if I put a chain or a pair of nucks or something in there? And all due credit to Dr. Feelgood. He ran some shows for a while early on in both of our careers. And he was trying to think of an interesting finish to come up that would, you know, we could use and incorporate the bear into the match. And he came up with this great finish, and where I think it was a singles match, if I remember right, where, you know, I once let the heel take heat, I just, every time, instead of selling, you know, I wasn't doing the Ricky Morton and looking to the crowd for sympathy, I kept looking to the teddy bear for sympathy. And would, you know, try to crawl over the bear and then have the heel cut me off. And finally, that this ends in me finally reaching the bear after my comeback, and then turning into a tug of war, where eventually I would just let go of the bear and let the heel hit himself in the face with the teddy bear, and then take the big bump to cover him, and then while the ref is checking on the heel, going, you know, what the heck, it's a baby face, it's a stuffed animal, how's this guy knocked out? And while the ref is
right,
pull the chain out of the back, show the crowd, and then hide it when the ref turns back. And it got a huge pop, just like we expected, you know. And that became, you know, that became a finish I used so many times. Every time I'd go into a new territory or a new promotion where the crowd had not seen me before, I would tell the booker or the promoter, hey, I've got this great finish. And, you know, they liked it, and usually – you know, second or third time I'd work for them, we'd break out that finish, and it kind of really established my character and who it was, you know, for that particular area. So I'll do credit Dr. Feelgood for that one. I can't thank him enough. That finish probably helped my character more than anything I can think of.
That's so great. That is so great. Oh, my God. Oh, so what were some of the really – since you were trained by some great people and like you said, polished up with some great, what were some of the really good promotions back in the day that you worked at you wish were still around?
Well, I mean, I went all over.
Or if there's new ones, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I always liked working for Susan. And I'm not going to lie, and I think she was probably partial because I was one of, you know, I was one of her boys, she liked to call me. She always treated me with deference and gave me a push and figured me in, which I appreciated. And I hope that I hope I lived up to whatever you did for me, you know, whatever you used to.
Definitely.
So, you know, I appreciate that. I worked there, you know, there was Johnny Walker, who ran American Championship Wrestling. Susan worked for him some too.
Yeah.
I thought he had a really nice setup down there in Myrtle Beach when he was doing television on the coastal, you know, Carolinas. But, you know, every good thing has to come to an end. I thought he used a nice mix of, you know, good guys in the area combined with, you know, vets and people from television. I enjoyed work. I was kind of glad when he got rid of that one ring that was harder than a concrete floor. That I'm not going to lie about. I believe that was Chad Rocco's ring. God rest his soul, you know, but I missed working for him a lot. I worked a lot in Georgia in the early 2000s for NWA Wildside, which was the combination of Rick Michaels' old NCW and Bill Barron's NWA Georgia. And, of course, it was kind of the remnants of it and Burt Prentice's territory up in Nashville or what were the early days of TNA. So that was fun to work for. Got to see, you know, guys like AJ Styles when he first broke in, because that's where he broke in.
Right.
And guys like Prince Justice, who would go on to become Abyss. He got probably his first big TV exposure there. And what was cool about working there at the time was they had a deal with the power plant. So a lot
right.
of the lower end guys that WCW had there at the end, or guys that, you know, they would send them in, and they would work a lot of the Friday night shows, which were their non-television taping, to get, you know, work in front of a crowd. And most of those guys were really cool. You know, they were very appreciative of the guys like us who weren't under WCW contract, because, you know, they were like, hey, you're doing this because you want to do it, and you're doing it the old school way, the hard way. You know, got to know David Flair a little bit there. David,
somebody
really cool guy. Worked for Dusty a few times for Turnbuckle. Anytime you got to interact with a Dream, that's always was interesting. You know.
Yeah.
But I mean, growing up in the Carolinas in the 80s, was there a bigger baby face than Dusty Rhodes? No.
No.
That was a dream come true.
No.
That was a dream come true.
Exactly.
I got to work up in the Maritimes. Oh, what was that promoter's name? Up in Nova Scotia and Newfoundland. That was kind of nice, but that was only like one trip.
Well, that's cool.
I was lucky being because of Bill Barron's having, you know, some of the contacts he did, like Howard Brody in Florida with the NWA, getting to go over to Europe, getting to wrestle, you know, over the country with those. That was kind of nice. I never really stayed in one area very, very long. I don't know if my gimmick was set up to stay in one area very, very long.
Right.
I wouldn't say I was
right.
a special attraction, but by the same time, I'm never going to be your main event guy, you know, and I'm also never going to be a guy that, I mean, I'd usually go run one, you know, 1-3-4 month program and then be gone. So,
right.
But those are some of the highlights of places I can think. I mean, the thing for me was, and Susan was one of the people that smartened me up with this, you know, Bubba did, my trainer. When you get to a territory, when you get to a new area, you're going to figure out who knows what they're doing, who doesn't.
And
you might want
right.
to make friends with them early on, because who you know helps a lot.
Yeah.
And, you
yeah.
know, it was through those contacts. That's why I got to travel so much. Getting to know people, make friends,
right.
that led to my first tour of Japan. That led to my first trip down to Puerto Rico. That led to my first trip over to Europe. Now, of course, once you get those kind of opportunities, it's your job to give the promoter a reason to book you again. You know, if
right.
you're an American and you go overseas, give them a reason to bring you back.
Mm-hmm.
And I always did. You know, it's don't bull your opportunity. I also got
well, that's,
to know,
I,
you know,
right.
I also got to know Bob Windham, or Blackjack, who, of course, trained with Susan. And
yeah.
he would say that all the time. He's like, kid, you got, what, 5-10 minutes to prove yourself? Go out there and do it, you know?
Yeah.
And he was a firm believer in that. He told me that multiple times, and I took it to heart.
Oh, yeah. And see, things like this need to be heard today. Things like this need to be told to the new kids today that are coming into this business. You know, you just can't walk in and be a superstar. You just can't walk
they
in.
They don't
and
know
think,
what hard times
oh.
are.
No, but no. here's the thing, but they also not trained
no.
what business means. You know, they're
yeah.
not trained like he said, you got 5-10 minutes to prove yourself, go out and do that. And if you want to give something to a you want to give something to a new territory, whether it's in the States, overseas, or whatever, to bring you back, regardless of where it's at. You want to show that you belong there. You belong, period. And that's hard. These kids just want to come in and do all this stuff, and then like, dude, that didn't make none of that made sense.
Go ahead. You can tell though. There are certain individuals that, I mean, it's kind of obvious from the jump based on physique or actual athletic ability or just aptitude to the business. They're going to get chances other people aren't going to get. But it doesn't mean you change your attitude. That's where I have a lot of respect for AJ Styles, because I remember seeing him, oh, my gosh, he hadn't even had his first match yet. And Rick Michaels was telling me, oh, Train, you've got to see this kid. He's going to make it in this business, and he's going to make it big. And, you know, I saw him, and I was, well, he's small, but this is, we're talking, you know, early 2000s, where smaller guys were beginning to be more accepted, you know, with the rise of, like, you know, the Eddie Guerreros, Dean Malenkos, guys like that. And I could see, you know, obviously AJ had the athletic ability, but he never had the attitude, you know. He was still very much a family man. He was very, you know, very true to where he came from. And he was very humble. You know, at the end of WCW's run, him and Frank Paris, Eric Paris, got signed out of the Wild Side. And then through no fault of their own, the company went under. And instead of, you know, turning to Vince right away or complaining, he came right back to Wild Side where he started, and that was that. You know, he never had an attitude. Just said, hey, if I got to start back on the bottom, I'll start back on the bottom. I think there's something to be learned from that, and a lot of kids don't understand it, you know. Just because you've made it to the dance doesn't mean you're going to, you know, going to make it back, especially if you don't give them a reason not to. Xavier Woods, of course, you know, New Day's a huge act for Vince right now. Xavier started, you know, in the Atlanta area, and he went to school here in the upstate at Furman, and I got to know him then. And I got to be close to him right before he signed to go and tag with Jay Lethal in TNA. And I remember talking to him one time, and I'm like, I love your attitude, kid. And he's like, I've been around the business 7-8 years. And I've been around long enough to realize that I shared a locker rooms on independent shows with a lot of the guys I watched on TV growing up. He goes, so I learned really quickly, on your way up, you're going to come back down, and you're probably going to meet the people that you pass on your way back, on your way up. So why be a jerk?
Right.
And I think that's a great advice point.
Yeah. Well, speaking of awesome Austin Creed, I was in Atlanta working for Rocky Johnson. Not Rocky Johnson. What's the guy down there? Dang it. Yeah. Anyway, not the Rock side. The guy that was he was a talent. I don't want to call him a jobber. He wasn't a jobber. But anyway, he was down there, and we were working, and I didn't know Austin Creed was going to be on the show. And my twin boys were there, and Brandon was probably 14, 15 at the time. He's 24 now, so it had to have been. So anyway, we were down there, and there's nobody there. You know, we're all just about 6-7 of us in the locker room. People started, you know, families and wrestlers started coming in. There was no fans yet. So my son jumps in the ring, running the ropes a little bit, and Creed walk in, and he goes, hey, can I get in the ring with you? And he's, yeah, whatever. So next thing you know, we start hearing bumps in the ring, you know. We're like, who's in the ring? And the promoter goes, I don't know. So we kind of peek out the door, and there's my son wrestling Creed in the ring. And next thing you know, about 5 minutes later, Creed comes walking in and goes, whose kid's that? The promoter goes, it's Dave's kid. He goes, he walks over to me, introduced himself, shook my hand. He goes, the kid's good. I said, well, he's not going to pursue that. He's going to pursue basketball. He's not going to be a wrestler. He goes, kid's good. I'm just telling you. Which was pretty awesome. Funny. He was an awesome, nice guy, man. Funny thing,
but Velvet, I hate to break in, but the professor is on board with us now.
I know
Steve Logan.
He wants a couple questions. Let Crazy finish what he's going to say, and I'll get to him.
Funny story about it's up Austin. To you. Just wanted to let you know, buddy.
Hang on. Let him. He already sent me a text. Go ahead, there, Crazy.
Austin. Well, that is his real name is Austin, and that's what I'll always call. That's something I have to tell people all the time. I do my own podcast, and I'm the insider on it. You know, it's all fans that do it with me, and they're like, "Why do you call Xavier Woods Austin?" I'm like,
"That's the real name.
That's how he introduced himself to me." And I'm like, "He's like, well, why do you call AJ Styles Allen? Because that's how he
that's
was
his real name.
Introduced himself to me when I first met him." And I'm like, you know, but why do I? They want to. Why do you call Paul Bearer Percy? Because the same reason that Susan calls Paul Bearer, God rest his soul, Percy. Because that's what he introduced himself to when you first met him, right, Susan?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I have to explain that to fans sometimes. I mean, it's like, you know, Crazy Train's not on my birth certificate, guys. But there are guys in the business that don't know. I mean, it's, you know, the people that have known me a long time, Dr. Feelgood, Bubba Kirk, Deion Johnson, you know, some of the guys that, you had been on your podcast here before.
Yes.
They called me Bolick, my last name, which was, you know, after Crazy Train, the most common name I was called in high school and college because I was a football player. And I remember I was in the office of the Booker down in Georgia, and it was Rick Michaels, another guy who calls me Bolick, and David Young and him were tagging together at the time. I don't know if you all remember David from TNA. He was in the Diamonds in the Rough. Yeah. So David comes in, and he Rick calls me Bolick two or three times. Dave's like, "Who's Bolick?" And I'm like, "I am, Dave." He goes, "Well, hell, I always thought you were Crazy Train." He's like, "I've known you 6 months, and I've always called you Crazy Train." I said, "Well, I never told you what my name was." You know, so it is what it is. But anyway, back to Austin. So Austin really, that is his name, and he really is a doctor. He got his, you know, he's gotten his PhD since he signed with Vince. And I always ask him, why did you, not that I'm not impressed, I'm very impressed. And he's like, "Because I want Vince to have to call me doctor."
Right.
I thought it was funny. But anyway, when he was in Greenville going to Furman, his original, he double majored in psychology.
Yep.
And I can't remember what the other one was, but he wanted, if wrestling didn't work out, his dream and his goal was to work with special needs children, especially autistic and Down syndrome kids. My oldest son is autistic, and him and Austin became thick as thieves early on in my meeting Austin. I was still married at
That's
the time,
awesome.
And he would come over before, you know, after we'd work out, and you know, my ex-wife would have made dinner for us and stuff, and I remember, I think probably about 8 years ago, I would have to, you know, come over and watch him when my ex would work. She worked second shift, and I was walking into their home, or walking, they lived in an apartment complex at the time, and here I am walking in, and Austin and Kofi Kingston are walking out, and, you know, "Hey, brother, how you doing? What are you doing here?" And I'm giving, you know, I gave him a big old hug, and he introduced Kofi to me, and Austin could say, super nice guy, you know, and I said, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "Well, you know, I thought I'd stop by and see," because they were in Greenville for a Raw or SmackDown or something, you know. And I was like, "Are you not going to give, you know, a brother a heads up when you're in town?" He goes, "I didn't come here to see you."
Right, I came to see your kid.
He came here specifically to see my son, Matthew, which that should give you an idea of what kind of guy he is. You know, I mean, he's a good person.
Yes, he is. Well, so before we go any further, the professor of wrestling, Steve, is on the line. He has a couple questions for you. So, Steve, take it away.
Sure. You kind of answered one of my questions earlier. You said you got the Crazy Train name from playing football.
Mm-hmm.
Or my love of Ozzy Osbourne, whichever one you want to take.
Yeah. I made that joke recently. I was like, Ozzy wrote that song about Crazy Train, didn't he, Velvet? And like on the retro last week. But
not Ozzy, but Randy Rhoads and Bob Daisley wrote the lyrics. Just to be clear,
that is correct.
Oh,
good time.
Good time.
All right, Steve.
Yeah, you mentioned working in Puerto Rico and Japan. How was that, and did you return there?
I did two tours of Japan. I did a 4-week and a 6-week there. Puerto Rico I did just once. Fortunately for me, Susan and Bill White both kind of informed me what I was expecting going over there. It was different working Japan in the sense that that was a connection I had made down in Georgia. It was one of the WCW guys who was one of their lesser known cruiserweights named Jeremy Lopez. I don't know if any of y'all remember him. He did not get the huge push some of the other cruiserweights got, but he had contacts over there, and so did. And he helped get me and Jimmy Rave before Jimmy Rave ever really, you know, before he'd done his Ring of Honor, stuff like that, a few other guys. And I was probably on the biggest end of the guys that he helped get out over there. And he was working for Osaka Pro. And Osaka Pro specializes in the smaller guys, more in the cruiserweight, that blend of the lucha, you know, Japanese style, so it was a little different for me. It was also strange because I did not wrestle in my typical stuff I wore over here, you know, scrubs with the Chuck Taylor.
Right.
I wore gear, which I also have to explain to people. Just because that's what I wrestled in all the time doesn't mean I don't own gear. I've owned gear from day one. Everybody should own gear if they're going to be a wrestler.
Right.
I don't care. I mean, if you do a gimmick, you do a gimmick. But, I mean, you should still have a good set of – at least one good set pair of boots and two or three, you know, decent set of trunks or tights. So that was different. It was mostly six-mans when I first went over there. You know, opening match, and it would be three Americans, you know. Or Gaijin against three of the local guys. It was not as difficult as I thought it was going to be to communicate. Well, we had a good interpreter in the locker room who kind of helped us talk out the match a little bit. But more than anything else, and I think this was Susan that told me, it might have been Bill. He's like, it's not going to matter because you speak wrestling. That's what matters. So
right. Getting thrown is getting thrown.
Yeah, the language is going to be the same. You know,
yeah.
And I mean, it's something I think Bubba taught me. He's like, you know, when you come off the ropes, only a few things are going to happen, and there's only three bumps you can take. So always be ready. And you know, that helped.
Very good.
But then, you know, about a year later, they brought me back, and that time I moved a little farther up the card, but I was doing more tag team stuff. So it was easier probably doing tags than it was, you know, doing single stuff. And I don't think I was ever going to be the kind of guy that were going to push the singles. I didn't do that kind of style, but you know, but the Puerto Rican, I don't know who helped me get the Puerto Rican spot. I cannot remember, but I know Bill White was the one that really sparked me up to going down there. And this pretty
yeah,
much were, told me.
Was it Wild?
Oh yeah. Bill White told me straight up. He's like, look, you're very used to being like this super over baby phase. It gets all this sympathy, and you do the comedy. That's not going to work down there, kid. They're going to want violence, and they're going to hate you. And I'm like, he goes, so just deal with it. Get ready for it. And I was like, oh, that ain't going to happen. That ain't going to happen. Well, the first night I was down there, they tagged me up with Tony Anthony, Dirty White Boy.
Right.
And I told him, I said, Tony, I don't really know much about, and I met Tony before, had gone into Memphis a couple of times, and I said, I don't know if I can heal, and I've only been working about 8 or 10 years, and I've been almost exclusive baby face. Oh, don't worry, kid, we're going to get heat, don't worry about it. Oh, brother wasn't lying. we walked out in the locker room, and I kind of followed behind him and let, you know, I mean, I don't know if many of people know, Tony's not the tallest guy in the world, but he's as thick as an oak tree. I mean, he's a pretty big guy. And so he's already bigger than 85-90% of the people in the crowd to begin with, you know. And he's a good old country white boy from Tennessee. And he just starts running his mouth, and I swear, well, by the time we left, because we just screw finish, and we screwed the locals out of the pen. That's some of the most scared I've ever been in my life in a wrestling arena ever.
Wow.
Was trying to get back from the ring to the locker room, and we were in the middle of the card. We were like, you know, probably like match four on like a 6 or 7 match card. And I was like, "Oh my God, we're going to die. We're not going to get back to the locker room alive." And that's where I learned, you know, those old lithium batteries that were they're like short and squat in the early days of digital cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Down there in Puerto Rico is where I learned them things really hurt to hit you in the back of the head.
Yes, they do when they throw it at you.
Really, really hurt badly. And I remember Bill White had smartened me up to the fact, and I thought he was full of crap, you know, but
right.
he's telling the truth. He said, "Now you understand, there's going to be kids out front of the building, and they're going to make money to feed their family by selling rocks." I said, "For what, Bill?"
Oh,
just they're going to have names on them, the names of the heel wrestlers. They're going to sell them to the crowd to throw at the wrestlers. I'm like, "Come on, man." He goes, "No, I'm serious." He was serious. I mean, so it was. I cannot. It was just a 4-day weekend. I went down. I flew down on a Thursday morning. Flew back on a Monday morning. Worked Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I can't complain. I'm glad I did it. I can say I did it.
Right.
Not
right.
sure I'd ever want to go. I never went back. Don't think I'd ever want to go back. Unless they probably back as a baby face, because those crowds are brutal.
They're rough, baby. They
are true believers, and they expect violence for violence' sake. I mean, it's not like ECW hardcore death match level, but they expect
right.
I mean, you got to be snug down there. You got to make your stuff.
They
want to
be.
Good.
They want some brutality. They want some tatering going on. I got you.
Sure. It reminds me. I've heard guys talk about, you know, how did Whitey Caldwell and Ron White get over Knoxville? You know, Whitey Caldwell's what, 100-nothing, 5-foot-nothing.
Yeah.
Ron White. How were they so over? And when you go back and watch those matches, you realize they beat the crap out of each other and they bled.
Yes, they did.
And they had to do that because, as I've heard people say from that part, Tennessee that grew up on that wrestling, you know, when Costanza was running or was running that territory, and was like, you had to give them what was better than the coal mines and the factories they worked at. If they want, if you didn't give them something snug and tight, they weren't going to come. They just go to the bar and see a
right.
ball that was better than that, you know. So
well, that they,
you
the
know,
bar
that,
fight was going to be way better.
And you had to give them something that was better than that. And, you know, Whitey and Ron always did. So that's why it worked. And, you know, I mean, Susan, you've been down there to Puerto Rico. One of the few times I've seen a white girl be over as a baby face down there. Am I lying about how brutal those fans are down there?
No. If it's not blood and guts, they don't want to see it.
Did you ever work heel down there? I doubt you did.
No.
Did you?
No.
Monster Ripa. Was that her name?
Yeah.
That she
worked? Yeah, Monster. Yeah. She
Ron,
was awesome.
You talking about Rhonda Singh?
Yeah.
The great Rhonda Singh?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So I have to ask you, I don't think I've ever asked you this before, Susan. Would you go down there as a heel?
No.
Or he's not going
to? No. No. It was bad enough
no,
being a baby.
No, thank you.
I got right. So I got a couple things to share with you, Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about knowing names. I've been called Velvet for 20 years. Nobody has to. When people say, "Hey, Dave," or call me David, they're like, "Who's that?"
You're 3D.
It's me. Yeah. Dynamite Dave Deuce, baby.
Yeah, when you sent me as a message the other day on Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't recognize your I didn't know your last name, and right. You started to describe yourself, and I was like, oh, 3D.
3D.
You're like, oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
I jumped up and down. I was like, yes, somebody remembers. But go ahead.
No, I was going to say I don't think I ever. I mean, the last time I saw you, I think we were talking was what, Mula's funeral?
Yep. That's the last time.
When
I
was
saw
that?
You. Yep.
When was that?
Oh,
2004.
Susan, help us out here.
That sound right, Susan? 2003,
2004? Yeah.
Like that.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, I don't remember. But you're right. That's the last time I saw you.
Right, folks. We're old.
Yeah, we are. Oh, and speaking of old, it was Rocky King I was working for.
Oh, Rocky? Okay.
Down there. Yeah. So, anyway, I couldn't remember. My brain fried. I'm worried about this thing tomorrow I got to do. I got to get a biopsy on my lung tomorrow, so I'm kind of like freaking out. But anyway, this is helping me, though. This is my therapeutic moment.
Okay, can I throw in a therapeutic moment?
Sure, go for it, Todd.
All right. I just got asked Crazy Train. I heard you talk about how you were a fullback in high school.
Uh-huh.
You got the nick. You happened to pull the earphones off, and you were listening to some Ozzy.
Uh-huh.
So you were a fullback. So tell me, who are some of – I know who one of my favorite fullbacks are. He got jacked in carrying the ball, but he was like a blocker from hell. So tell me who you saw as a fullback, because if you were a fullback, you had to have a model or two that you followed. So who did you have as a model or two as a fullback?
Well, I really wanted – this is going to sound crazy. I actually wanted to play offensive line, and I actually did a little in high school. My minister in Denver when I was a young kid – had played 10 years in the NFL as a center. And he was – his name was Ken Peterson. And he played –
a center is a thug, just to be clear.
And Bishop Peterson was a – he played at Utah State with Merlin Olsen and played several years with the Vikings back when they – had gone.
Hey, the Vikings,
when they went to all their Super Bowls and lost in the 60s.
Lost
and
them
he
all
got
set
you
up.
Know,
now wait a minute. Now just look, you're talking about just for the record, a guy that grew up in the greater Cleveland area as always a classic Cleveland fan, but the old school Vikings under Bud. And I never and I later found out in life, the old coach of the Vikings back in that day was a former Marine and is a retired Marine. I just got a much greater affection for him. But those were one of the biggest set of studs ever. No matter what happened with them in Pittsburgh, look, I got a special affection for them. So please continue, and I just want to tell you I have a special affection for them.
Well, but you know, Bishop Peterson told me, learn how to snap the ball, learn how to long snap and from, you know, quarterback under center. And I was not quite old to start Little League yet. I was probably about 7-8 years old. And I was like, you know, why? And he said, well, you know, if you're going to play football, it's like anything else in life. The more skills you have, the more you can offer a coach. So I did. And I learned how to snap. And I played center mostly through Little League, through Pop Warner ball, because we had, you know, had a weight limit around here, and I was towards the top of the weight limit, so I was one of the biggest kids playing. So it made sense for me to be an offensive lineman. When I got to high school, the kids that were over the weight limit could now play ball, and I went to the middle of the size of the guys on the team. And I was a little faster than most by no means fast. Don't get me wrong. I got white boy's disease. But I was a little faster than a lot of the other guys playing offensive line, and my coach just suggested that maybe I move to fullback and on defense move to linebacker instead of defensive line like I'd played in Little League. And so that's what I did. But I still maintained my ability to long snap, and I was our long snapper, too, for extra point field goals and punts. And he liked having a guy who could do the long snap, but then could also run down and block, too. You know, had the knowledge on how to block. So anyway, to answer your question, I always was a fan of Larry Zonka, who people forget was a fullback because he did get so many carries. No, but, you know, the tailback for those Dolphins team, that was Mercury Morris, you know, who was a speed back. But, I mean, I kind of always approached the fullback position, especially the era I played in the triple option, with a linebacker's mentality. So I was a big fan of Dick Butkus growing up. But growing up in Denver in the 70s, and if you're a Browns fan, you'll remember this name. My hero was Lyle Alzado. There was an undersized guy that played with a chip on his shoulder and hit you like you wanted to take your head off of you. But as I got older and I realized, okay, this is going to be my lot in football life is probably going to be fullback. There were not really anybody that caught my eye until I was in college, and that's what I played in college. I walked on as the long snapper because the long snapper they had under scholarship blew his knee out in spring practice. And so they had open tryouts, and I had some guys who lived in the same dorms as me that were on the team, and they talked to the special teams coach, and well, you know, that was that. So, but anyway,
nice.
So thanks to Bishop Peterson, he was right. Knowing something that I never expected. I mean, I had gotten some offers for D2 and JUCO stuff out of high school, but nothing, you know, D1. And so playing for a D1 school was a dream come true. I never thought that was possible. You know,
that's a big deal. That's
a big deal.
That you got that.
And that's a big deal. And I do not. I don't look. I don't. Of all the things I did in wrestling, that the fact that I was able to be not a great athlete, not the strongest guy, not the biggest guy, but have a skill that a D1 school felt I could contribute to the team and make team might be my proudest athlete. You know,
that's no small feat when you do the math about what it takes to get there. I'm gonna follow that up with one of my favorite fullbacks, and he might have been a damn linebacker in the fullback position, was Lorenzo Neal.
Oh, God, yeah. He was a monster, wasn't he?
Dude, that guy cleared more people out of the way from 1,000-yard rushers than, like, I don't know if there's anybody that cleared more 1,000-yard rushers than he did.
Oh, no. I do think not. That, and I understand everything evolves, and I enjoy the game of football now, but it has changed. I always shake my head, and you see it in the NFL and in major college ball now, where they'll be down on the goal line, you know, and it's second down and goal, and they're on the 3-yard line, and they're running out of the pistol formation. I'm like, what? Dude, bring the jumbo package in and run an ISO.
Exactly.
why are you doing that? But I mean, it's come back to bite some teams. I've seen it happen. You know. But one of my favorite fullbacks of all time was a guy who was obviously at the peak of his career when I was in college, and that was Moose, Darrell Johnson with the Cowboys. I'm not a Cowboys fan. I'm a Broncos fan. Growing up in Denver.
Moose
was
awesome.
But, I mean, if you don't believe how important they are, go back, and you can find it on YouTube, go back and watch Emmitt Smith's induction into the NFL Hall of Fame and literally break down into tears describing how he would have never been there if it wasn't for Darryl Johnson opening holes for him.
Oh,
the great running back, they know.
That got so underrated in that time.
Well, I mean, most of your fullbacks nowadays are they're playing the H back. They might line if they're a little bit faster and have good hands. They might line them up in the slot. You know, a lot of times you'll have to bring in a second or third tight end and have him line up in an offset eye if you're going to run one. But very few teams actually carry a fullback anymore. You know, I mean, I guess
exactly.
Probably the last well-known fullback were probably Moose and Allstott. And Allstott was much like Zonka, and he got a lot of carry, you know. So.
Oh, he was.
The Vikings still have one today. Ham still plays today for the Vikings.
I think that Gordon, you know, to the roster lineups that they have for the Pro Bowl, both conferences have to carry one fullback for each Pro Bowl roster. So, I mean, obviously the league still feels that it's an important position, you know, and
it'll come back.
I mean, then again,
everybody does. Go ahead.
Well, I think then you have these running backs who play tailback, but they actually were fullbacks, like Jerome Bettis. Come on, the bus was a fullback playing tailback. You know,
exactly.
What I mean?
Exactly.
I mean, going to the University of Georgia, being a Georgia fan, Herschel Walker is God, and I still say this day, and you're gonna have to kill me to get me because I won't say it. He's the greatest college player of all time. I it pains me to say it. Yes, Tim Tebow's in the argument. I can't say any Gators in the argument.
Definitely one of the best, for sure.
No, he's one of the best. One of my favorite running backs. I was a Carolina fan, but he was still one of my favorite running backs.
You know, Bo Jackson, Jim Brown, these guys are all in the conversation, but I don't think he was better. But let's be honest.
No.
I mean, Herschel could have played fullback if he didn't play. The only reason he played tailback is because he had that kind of world-class speed. You know, he had that second, third gear. If he didn't have that kind of speed, Herschel would have had his hand on the ground playing fullback.
Yep. Agreed.
He would still drop by Athens when we'd have practice. And this is, you know, in the 90s. So he was only a few years removed from the league. You know, he just retired.
Right.
So he was late 30s, early 40s. And I saw him.
Still looks amazing to this day.
Yeah, I saw Herschel probably back in about 2014, 2015, at a spring game I went down to. The guy's in his 60s, and he looks like he could pad up and play today.
He's a freak of nature.
And freak of – come on, he made the Olympic bobsled team. And he never even
– I know, right?
He lived in South Georgia. It never snows in Georgia. Like, come on.
No.
The guy, he's an insane athlete. I often wondered, what if he'd have thought about becoming a wrestler? I don't know. Herschel's so nice, I don't know if he could actually work. You know, I mean, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, he's too nice of a guy.
That's probably why he had a successful MMA career after in his 50s. Yeah, he only had like
three
fights and he won them all. Good Lord.
And he's like, I can't do this.
I want to throw like an oddball thing out there based on somebody you mentioned. You mentioned how Jerome Bettis should have been the fullback. You know, you want to talk finesse. You realize that guy has multiple 300 bowling games under his belt?
Probably. You talk about the Steelers.
I mean, it's just, you know, as big a brute as he was, he actually had a level of finesse that was unreal.
I saw this in wrestling, especially when I went and did, like, TV for WCW or WWF, some of the people I've met. It started actually with my minister in Denver. I saw it in college. One of my college roommates, speaking of the Steelers, was Hines Ward. Probably the most naturally gifted athlete
gifted
I've ever been.
Talent, exactly.
And competitive. Competitive. There is something extra about guys at that level you don't understand. I mean, you know, he was in a fraternity that was really close to my fraternity. And the couple, you know, they would come over, and Hines knew me because we were on the team together. And we had a pool table and we had a dartboard at our fraternity house. Hey, you want to throw darts? You ever thrown darts before, Hines? Nah. And I was pretty good at darts. And I had to work hard to keep up with them. This guy never thrown them before, you know? Just the, you know, the natural athletic ability. And I don't think a lot of guys on the independents in wrestling understand that you better do something to separate yourself in this business, like we were talking about earlier, because the guys mm-hmm. with that kind of natural athletic ability, they're already going to be getting a look you're not going to be getting, you know?
Correct.
And is that fair? No, but life ain't fair, you know?
Right.
You cannot blame
somebody else, exactly.
Mm. The best look I ever got on that, I had a tryout with Vince McMahon back in 2002. And we kind of got the thanks, but no thanks when we were done. And was basically told by Kevin Kelly at the time that, you know, you in ring, you can work, you know what you're doing, you know how to bump, all those kind of things, but look at yourself, you know. And I was, by my own admission, not as dedicated in the gym as I should have been. I still worked out every day, but I worked out more to prevent myself from getting injured. I wasn't worried about looking, you know, super athletic. I was married and had kids at the time. And by this time, I discovered my son with special needs, and, you know, it was what it was. I don't have any complaints about it. It's my own doing. I don't have any regrets. But what Kevin Kelly said, you just think about this. Vince McMahon, if he signs you, is going to dump hundreds of thousands of dollars into marketing you. Things like T-shirts and action figures. Can you look in the mirror right now and see yourself on a T-shirt?
Mm.
And I was like, whoa. That kind of made me step back. And it made me realize something that Susan had taught me and preached. Not everybody – I'm not saying everybody has to look like Lex Luger did in his heyday. But you better be unique. You better
– right.
Why can't – if you – a lot of people complain about the current product. A lot of fans do. And I'm no different than they are, but I have a different viewpoint on it. I can't go to wrestling shows nowadays. I go in locker rooms and I see a lot of these kids and I'm like, have any of you ever been to a real fight?
Right?
Have any of you ever been hit in the face for real?
Nope.
Have any of you ever done anything athletic in the world? Well, no. Well, then how in the hell are you supposed to go out there and simulate a fight if you've never been in a real one?
Well, hold on. Let me throw another part on that. Okay, I'm a much older generation, Crazy Train. Let me throw this out there. There was many of the kids I grew up with, and we flipped jabs and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. And we were at a certain age where we had a fight, and win, lose, or draw, we were pretty good about opening a beer for one another afterwards. It was just
sure.
kind of the way it was. It was just like, okay, it is what it is. You whooped me, I whooped you, or we had a draw. All right, we good? Yep.
And that's
not the case today.
No, it's not. And it's not just – not just the kids in the locker rooms. It's just it is the generation that they've grown up.
Kids in general, right?
Right. It, you know, the college age kids, you know, the high school age kids, and I don't think you can undersell the effect that mixed martial arts and the rise of it has had on professional wrestling, because
Shayna Baszler.
Let's be honest. There were so many. There are guys from generations past, had mixed martial arts been a money-making proposition in that era, wrestling would have never seen them. And I'm talking Hall of Fame guys. Do you think a Jack Briscoe or a Danny Hodge or a Vern Gagne would have become a pro wrestler if they could have made the same kind of money in a shoot fight back then? No.
No.
No. No.
I mean, Susan, you're friends with Danny.
if Danny had an opportunity to be in a UFC environment in 1955 as opposed to a worked environment wrestling and make the same money, which one would he have taken?
Well, he would have took the shoot. I mean,
well,
of course he would have.
You know,
exactly.
Kids, on the reunion, while that did sit there and say, "How did you bake that apple to make it still look like a fresh apple?" And he said, "Because it was still a fresh apple." You know, that he could crush that apple with his hands. Oh yeah,
because he was a real badass. Excuse my language.
Yeah,
yes, he was. No, he was.
Yeah.
I mean, pound for pound,
got to talk to him.
I
got to talk to
him
in Mobile.
Yeah, I got to talk to him in Mobile. He was. Go ahead.
I'm at Luthez. I mean, just shaking his hand, you could tell. Oh,
yeah.
this guy could hurt you, and he was in his 70s.
Right.
First question he asked me in Dr. Feelgood. Well, what's your amateur background? Mm-hmm. He wasn't happy that neither one of us wrestled in high school or college, but he gave us a pass because I was a black belt in judo and Dr. Feelgood was a black belt in karate. So at least we had some background in combat sports.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then he found out that I played football in college. Oh, okay. Oh, you're one of those. Which, you know. But
yeah,
I also
that's another pass.
I think, you know, we brought up Xavier Woods earlier. And he, of course, has had a ton of success with his YouTube channel that now Vince backs on his video gaming. Well, I can tell you, you know, Austin, that's legit with Austin. He's a big-time video gamer, big-time comic book geek.
Yeah, he is.
Well, so am I, at least comic book geek. But it doesn't mean that I didn't play sports. And don't sleep on, Austin was a wrestler in high school. You know, he was a real athlete, too. But so many of the kids nowadays that get in the business, they don't have the combination like Austin does, you know. And they don't understand that. Austin is setting himself up so that when his ring career is over, he has another career.
Right.
And is going to be able to make money in it. Exactly.
Right.
And believe
me. Well, here's something
these,
I wanted to tell you. Go ahead.
I was going to say, a lot of those kids might try Austin. He'll mess them up. He may not be a big guy, but he might be a big guy, but he's tough. My father who got me into judo, because he was into judo in the military, he came and worked out with us one time and brought his gi and had me change into my gi. And here's Austin getting ready to go to TNA, and he is, like, really paying attention and wanting us to show him stuff. He was wanting to learn how to hook somebody, you know, how to hurt somebody if you had. And I'm like, you know, I don't know if you're going to see that. And this was back in 2004, 2005. I don't know if you'd have that with a lot of the kids nowadays. Why do I need to know that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you something that I was thinking about, and I think that you and I need to talk off of this about it, but there needs to be a seminar. There needs to be a seminar to teach these kids to set themselves up for success after wrestling. Success in the business, because nobody teaches them business. They need to know how to take care of their business. They need to build their brand if they got one. If not, if you run the indies for 30 years, you need to be successful that you can make money at it. So when it's over, you still can do something. Or, you know what I'm saying? Everybody teaches them here's how to wrestle, kid. Well, go at it. They don't teach them anything business. And I think what you are talking about, I think if we could get a group of guys like you, me, and a few others, and Susan and whoever, we can teach them the business side of this too, you know?
Right.
Because a lot of
how many guys are running schools nowadays that say they're going to teach you how to be a wrestler, and they shouldn't even be training themselves because they don't know how to wrestle.
Right.
Oh, correct.
Yeah. No, we know that. We know that.
That's the first thing. The second thing I've helped train. I've come down to Susan and worked out with her. Her training in the past.
Right.
Many
you know?
A time.
Right.
Sure. And I tell some of the kids I've helped train, I'm not going to teach you how to wrestle. I'm going to teach you how to be a professional wrestler.
Right.
And they're like, huh?
Exactly.
And I'm like, there's a difference. On the podcast that I co-host, We It's called Classic Wrestling Memories. Cheap plug. Check us out. We're on every podcast platform you can think of. Yeah, yeah. Spotify, Apple Pods, Google Play, all those. But anyways.
Right.
Cool. Our first episode was about Starrcade 83. And we had Mike Moodyham on as a guest to talk about it. Of course, you know, he was
right
in the middle of covering wrestling for the Charleston Paper Times.
Oates and Curry, right.
And,
yep.
And we were talking, and I said something, and he agreed with me. The kids nowadays, athletically speaking, amazing. They are way better athletes than most of the guys from my era and the era before me that I grew up on.
Right.
You know, I mean, they're not everybody was Ricky Steamboat. I mean, he's just, you know, a God-given natural athlete. But they can't work like we could.
Nope.
You know, they couldn't work. I mean, they can't, like, going back to the whole real fight thing, how many of them can throw a work punch? They can't. That's why they all do forearms nowadays. You know? Now you look at somebody like, I don't know, Jerry Lawler, who was a better athlete than people give him credit for. You're not as good in soccer as Jerry is, if not. But Jerry didn't have a great body. Jerry was not the biggest guy. He was smart. He took big bumps, but he was smart about when he took them. They meant something, you know. But tell me anybody from was in Memphis for 30 years that didn't believe he was taking a guy's head off when he punched him.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
don't get me wrong.
Said something similar.
I mean, don't get me wrong. If you know, Jerry wanted to really hit you and hurt you, he could. You can ask Paul Heyman in his jaw about that. You know. But by the same token, when he wanted to work it, it looked like he was killing you. He never touched you. So, but I think that
that's funny.
You know, they don't know how to work. It's a combination of a lot of things. It's a combination of I was coming into the business as the territories had just died, and it was two national promotions, and I was smart and underground. I was a little older than most guys because I was out of college when I started training. So I was 24, 25. And so I had a little bit of maturity on me. And I understood, I could look back and see. And I was reading the dirt sheets by that point. I was a tape trader in the 80s. So I was what we would call a smart, now I was a smart in the 80s.
Right.
I understood a reason a lot of these guys were good were because they were wrestling every night of the week. You know, these guys, even if they were enhancement talent, you know, they were still getting in the ring every night with a Tully Blanchard, with a Barry Windham, with a Jerry Lawler, with, you know, with a Pat Patterson. Somebody knew what they were doing.
Right.
They knew how to draw money. They knew how to get heat. They knew how to get shine as a baby face. So first off, the kids don't have that anymore. But I realized early on, I don't care if there's five people in the crowd and I get paid a hot dog dinner. My first 3-4 years, almost 5 years in the business, I took any booking I could get. Because I realized I just have to get in front of a crowd.
Right.
And then when I got to a point to where I realized, okay, you kind of know what you're doing a little bit here, Train, then I got a little bit more selective about who I'd work for, worried about getting pay, stuff like that, you know?
Right,
but,
exactly.
So there's that, but there's also, you know, they don't have that much to – and they don't have – the other advantage of that was riding – from town to town, the backseat schoolhouse, driving a car with vets in it or sitting in the backseat with vets, driving with vets and getting a chance to talk to them. I mean, when I broke into the business, the guys that weren't on TV but had been on TV when I was a kid, they were the same guys I was sharing a locker room with. This is how I got to know people like, you know, Chief. It's how I got to meet Stan Hansen. And how they would, you know, it's how I got to meet Bob Windham. You know, that it was, they don't have that either. So it's a lot of things going on.
Right.
You know, and it's just, I remember when I was a kid and a fan waiting out behind the Greenville Memorial Auditorium to meet the wrestlers and get their autographs. And I remember, and I was probably about 13, 14 years old, asking Wahoo McDaniel, "Hey, I want to become a wrestler. How does that happen?" And he looked at me and he laughed and he said, "Go to school."
Right.
Go to school.
And I did not understand what he meant at the time. Now, you know, fast forward years later, and I'm actually getting to know him, and I tell him that story, and he goes, man, I had 1,000 kids ask me that. But, right. I mean, he said, you know, I still go by that advice today. I don't want to train.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely. I don't want any kid training unless they've got a backup plan. Because it is such a cutthroat business, and it is so hard to make money in it.
Well, now it's political.
I mean, sure, there's a lot of that.
Very political.
But, Susan, correct me if I'm wrong. You told me once Joe Blanchard wouldn't train you until you finished school. Isn't that correct?
Oh, yeah. He finally went out. My parents went before the governor, and the governor said I could get licensed. He said only on the weekends off or the holidays from school. So I actually got to wrestle. On the holidays from my junior year and my senior year. But he definitely didn't want
John.
To.
Good.
To give you an idea of what the kids are like nowadays, about probably had to be 2019 because it didn't happen in 2020 with COVID. But I think it was 2019, I think, or maybe 2018. And there's, you know, even though Wildside has gone under, there's still promotions that run in the same building they ran there in Georgia. And one of the guys that had started out around the same time as AJ Styles, named Azriel, is training for them now. And he asked me to come down and get in the ring with his kids. And I did. And they had two girls.
You're in. He's in. Never mind.
And
go ahead.
I remember talking to two of the girls that were his trainees, and I didn't know them from Adam's House Cat or anything about them. He just told me, get in here and do this with them. I said, sure, no problem. And I was talking to them and asking them, you know, and I think somehow in talking to them about what they'd just done, I mentioned Harley Race. And they had this perplexed look on my face, on their faces. And I was like, do you know who Harley Race is? And they said, no.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
I looked over at Azriel, and he had the most embarrassed look on his face. When all the trainees had left and him and I were talking, he spent 5 minutes apologizing to me training that did not know who Harley Race was. And he's like,
wow.
You know, that was only like her second time working out, you know. And I was our training session. And I said, so she drove up here an hour and a half, paid you what she paid you, got beat up for something she doesn't even fully understand. He goes, yep, seems like. I mean, that's like asking, you know, some guy who's playing Division I college baseball in Clemson or Carolina or LSU or somewhere like that, and tell him, well, you know, you need to, you know, maybe watch, you know, like Ted Williams used to do. Who? That's what it's like, you know. maybe you need to change your stance more like Mickey Mantle. Who?
Exactly.
How do you? What? That's what you're dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead, Dr. John.
Well, I was going to say that the maestro is with us. Papa Stro, how are you doing tonight?
Great to be here with you guys. Sorry I was late to the party. I just got through watching the Royal Rumble. It kind of went all along, but it was decent for what it's worth. You know, I mean, in my opinion, humble opinion, I really thought the women's Rumble match tonight really stole the show, man. It was top notch. So I enjoyed it.
Yep, Susan Green will tell you that the women can steal the show, can't they, Susan?
Oh yeah, when given the opportunity, and some of the girls that. Well, with WWE, definitely have been trained and know how to walk the walk.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Papa Stro, we're glad you're here. Velvet, let's get Papa Stro into this little mix here with Crazy Train and Susan.
Absolutely.
Hey, Velvet. Hey, Susan. Always a pleasure. My favorite tag team partner in pro wrestling, Susan Green. The legendary Susan Green. Amazing.
Thank you.
She's the best, for sure.
That Crazy Train. Pleasure, brother.
I don't, you know, sure, I'm trying to think. I don't know if we ever worked a show together back in the day.
I'm not sure if, you know, I've gone to other aliases, you know, Gorgeous George the Third after my grand uncle and Robbie Eagle years ago.
I worked for Gronk a couple of times. I'm thinking maybe you were on one of those shows.
Yeah, he managed me. Yeah, for SCW there in Raleigh, yeah. When I was Gorgeous George, yeah. We had some good times.
It was somewhere on the other side of Raleigh, if I remember right.
Yeah, I used to call him Count Chocula because he looked like Dracula.
He sure did.
I love Count Chocula cereal, man, with the marshmallows and everything, man. I was such a mark for Count Chocula,
stupid.
Man, for real.
Well, my tag partner for years, I got us that booking, and he would come out. You know, he came out of the Stallion George South group of guys. I'm pretty sure that's how he got that booking up there. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how he got that booking up there.
That's funny. That's great.
Good stuff.
You never worked for Thomas and Matt and Jeff when they were first running Omega, did you?
Oh yeah, we go way back, man. Omega and all that, and we bumped each other a lot of indie shows back then. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I worked one show for them, and I'm about 6'1", 250. My partner's about 5'10", about 270. And I remember we showed up, and the doc had gotten us the booking. And Matt introduced himself, and I remember looking around, and they had Jason at the time, you know,
right?
Because he was, and I was like, "Where's the heavyweight?" And Matt points at me, he points at my partner, he points at Jason, and he goes, "That's it."
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. Okay.
Yeah, I joined the whole clique: Matt, Jeff, Shane Helms, Shannon Moorman.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, we worked Shane and Mike Maverick that night when they were doing the serial thriller gimmick. Yeah.
Oh, Mike Maverick. Yeah, I remember Mike. Yeah.
Yeah, Mike's a good guy. And Champagne, you may like Marty, you may hate
Champagne.
Him,
first name Champagne, last name Pain.
He knew how to get heat, didn't he?
Oh, he was a character, brother. Very entertaining. I always loved Champagne, man.
God, that was like three lifetimes ago. Good Lord.
Right? Time flies, bro.
It does. Crane, how old are you now?
Almost 50.
What do you mean almost 50? No, I'm just kidding.
I'll be 50 in a few months.
Hey, congratulations.
Congrats for joining the club. I will be 54 in June. Believe it or not, little old 3D will be 54.
Now if you've been in the ring with Susan, you know that I'm not lying when I say this. The story I was telling earlier about when I got hit in the back of the head with the camera battery down to PR. That's
right.
second stiffest thing that ever happened to me in a wrestling ring. The stiffest thing that ever happened to me in a wrestling ring was a little tiny show that Susan ran somewhere down in the Midlands of South Carolina where I got eliminated in a battle royal, and she didn't know who I was, I guess, or she was just pissed at me. I don't know. And I turned in a T-lift from her. I thought she knocked the back of my head, my forehead to the back of my head. I literally saw
stars. Oh, mercy.
I got hit on the football field in college. It wasn't that hard, okay? On the kickoff team. And I remember looking up. I remember looking up Susan going, "Damn, sister, I thought we were cool. I thought we had something the way you hit me. Good God."
You're feeling the love, right?
Yeah, right.
Zero selling involved. Zero selling.
Oh, right.
All
you had
real
automatic.
That was tough love there. Tough love.
I'm gonna smart you up tonight, kid.
Right. We had a kid right after y'all left. It's been quite a few years after y'all gone. This I'm gonna do this real quick because it's usually a long story, but we had this kid going to wrestle Susie on the show. Well, some intermission, I'm finally getting my boots on and my stuff on. I see Susie walk up and she goes, "We got a problem." I go, "What do you mean we got a problem?" She goes, "Kid ain't here." I said, "What do you mean the kid ain't here?" He took his bag, left, and went home. because he didn't want to wrestle Susie. So the running gag was I was going to take one for the team. So I said, okay, I'll take one for the team. She goes, you know this is a no-holds-barred, last man standing, blah, blah, blah. And I said, are you freaking kidding me? You're joking, right? I said, you're joking. She goes, no. So, yeah, I hit the Coke machine twice. I took a flat bump on the cement wall. I rolled down the stadium stairs. She broke two kendo sticks over me. Then, Susie, what happened? Please tell them this part of the story, Susie. What happened with the door?
The guys were peeking out the door. And I said, here we go. And the door opened up to the inside. So whenever I told Velvet, here we go, I shot him through that door. You should have seen everybody scatter.
Yeah, they were peeking through, crazy. They were peeking through the door. And she's like, get out of the way. Get out of the way. You know, she's dragging me by my boot. She's dragging me by my boot, telling me to get out of the way. And they're like, what? She throws me through the door, right? So the door closes. I'm laying on the floor. She comes around the other side and says, you know, the match ain't over yet. I said, oh, wait a minute. Give me 5 minutes. She goes, we ain't got 5 minutes. I went right back out through the door. To make that story short, I went to work, and I work in third shift, and I wore a short-sleeve shirt. And I was managing and stocking at the same time in the store, right? And I'm throwing product up, and this guy, my shirt keeps flying up. And this guy goes, dude, what's wrong with your arm? I said, nah, nothing. So later, he saw the other side, and the other side was worse. He goes, man, what the hell? So I took my shirt off. My ribs were all swollen. I was black and blue all the way around my torso. My shoulders and my arms down to my elbow. So he goes, dude, were you in a car? He goes, were you in a car accident? I said, pretty much.
Susie, you're the car wreck.
We had Listen. To be tight. We were out there with the people.
Oh, we were in that people's eye. Yeah, she told great. She goes, ball your fist up and hit me, you know, flat side of the hand, hit me as hard as you can. I said, are you sure? She goes, hit me as hard as you can. So I said, okay. I rear back and I wham right in her gut. I looked at her and she goes, I went, oh, crap. I went to run and I had hair at the time. Grabbed me by the back of the hair and I went, this is fun. I want to quit. But we had fun.
Did you work?
I've wrestled
That's
Susie
right.
so much.
Did you work that show in Township where I think the main was Susan and Tracy Richards? But they had me tagging with Bugman against those two kids that kind of wore the Hawaiian shirts all the time. They were from like Florida.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
Do you remember? Do you remember what happened to the kid when he went to the floor?
Hang on a minute. Let me think.
First off, let me paint this picture because I don't know if Susan remembers that Stro wasn't at that when they worked the show. So I've been working at that point about 6-7 years. So I was just kind of starting to learn what I was supposed to be doing. The guy that they put me in that was attacked, my tag partner, is wrestling the semi-main against Bubba that night. And I get told by Ron was booking the time, Ron Grady. He said, Train, I'm going to need to help me out.
Ron Grady.
And I said, what do you need me to help you out with? He said, we're going to tag you with, I can't remember that kid's name. And I said, how many matches has he had? He said, oh, about 5 or 6. I said, who are we working with?
That's JoJo.
Bugman, the Cajun kid that blew his knee out.
Oh, the Cajun kid that blew his foot out. Yeah. Yeah.
So he's in his 6th match. And the guys were working. One of them had their first match the week before against me and Charleston in the singles squash match. And the other kid, this is his first match. What exactly are you asking me to do, Ron? He said, carry this
right.
one. And, oh, Lord. And I remember telling all of them, do not go to the floor. Don't go to the floor. Don't go to the floor. I must have said that 1,000 times for the match. Don't, whatever you do, don't go to the floor unless I throw you there. And I did not let me explain to them why they didn't need to go to the floor. There were a multitude of reasons, obviously. Placement on the card, you're too green, whatever, right? But I tell them, don't go to the floor. So to start out with, early on when they took the heat on me, and the kid that was in his very first match, he backed me up in the corner. Now remember, this is the Township Auditorium. This is the same building the Crockett's ran in Columbia for, what, 30 years?
Yeah.
Yep.
And y'all have done a good job. You know, they've done a good job at promoting the show. And they had probably 800,000 marks in the building, which is really big for an indie show, you know. Well, it didn't hurt that we had, like, Wahoo was there, Susan was there. Didn't Mula come to that show, I think, maybe? I think Lillian was there.
I think
there.
She made appearances, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think Swede was there. Swede Hansen was there. So,
Swede Hansen.
Yeah. So that was part of the reason. I get it. The legends were on the show, you know, doing Q&As or a couple of them, like Susan was working, right? So,
yes.
So they, good job. But this kid backs me up, and he goes to do a knife-edge chop, and he barely touches me. And I look at him, and I'm like, try that again, kid. He whiffed worse the second time than he did the first time. I don't remember this. I have to have Dr. Feelgood, who was watching through the curtain, tell me what happened. He said my eyes got as big as two CDs. I started doing the Ronnie Garvin overhand chops. And I literally chopped him all the way down to the mat. And I remember when I came back, Dr. Feelgood asking me, were you going for a 10 count? And I said, no, I was so pissed I was chopping until my hand was tired. This is a building with a bunch of fans in it that grew up watching Blackjack Mullen against Wahoo Daniels just in a chop set. Ricky, Steamboat, and Ric Flair lighting each other up. I saw those in Greenville as a kid. And you're going to chop me and whiff? But, like, I had I didn't have a choice at that point. I had to show them this is real. Well, that was earlier. That was early on in the heat. We go to the finish. I make the hot tag. And the kid that I chopped, the first thing he does is take a powder. After I have explicitly told them 1,000 times, do not go to the floor. Do not go to the floor. So I immediately go after him out on the floor. And I protected him. I didn't hurt him. But I scooped him up, and I slammed him, and I dropped him from about chin level, flat back. One of the fans talked to me afterwards, and they were asking for an autograph. They said the kid bounced 3 times when he hit the concrete. Like, boom, boom, boom. Now, Dr. Fielding later on, he's standing next to Ron Grady and Swede Hansen when all this goes down. And Ron looked at Swede Hansen and said, welcome to the business. And he got Swede Hansen and said, yep. But the best part of it is, though, and this does not happen now in locker, which is why I don't go to shows now, that I didn't say anything to the kid. I went to the back. I shook his hand. I went to my area, started changing into my clothes. He walks up to me. Now, I do not know if Ron or somebody had pulled him over to the side and said something to him. But he comes up to me, puts his hand out, and this is the first thing out of his mouth. Thank you, Train. I will never chop someone in front of a crowd until I know what I'm doing. Thank you very much.
That's it. That's good.
Why do the kids nowadays not have that same attitude? I had that attitude when I started. It didn't hurt any that, you know, Susan and Bubba Kurt stretched me when I was a trainer.
I think we were talking about that earlier, right, Velvet? The same deal.
Yes, we were.
Yep.
We sure were earlier today.
I remember when we were talking about always, like when I went to Japan in the language barrier, which is wrestling, just be ready to bump. When I was first in training, and I hadn't worked the show yet, and Bubba Kirk, for those that don't know, Bubba Kirk was one of the first men that Mula trained back in the mid-80s, that's who trained me. Bubba just, you know, he got in the ring to work out, and he whipped me in and did not call a spot on purpose just to see if I was ready. He went for a drop toe hold. and I didn't bump. Well, instead of getting up and getting stiff with me or whatever, he just gets up and hooks me in a front face lock and then lays on me. And Bubba's just scored 275.
Yes,
and
sir.
He just lays there and doesn't say anything.
Right.
And waits until I use all of my strength and all of my energy to get up. And, of course, I'm completely blown up at that point. And then he lays down on top of me again. And that goes on for about 5-6 minutes. And I finally roll out of the ring. I'm like, I'm going to puke. And Brody Ray Chase, who ran the wrestling school I went to, Brody pulled me over to the side. And he says, kid, you realize Bubba Kirk could kill you if he wanted to. I said, yeah, I'm beginning to understand that. and he's like, he was just trying to teach you a lesson. I said, well, what was that? He said, always be ready to bump, because sometimes you're not going to hear spots. Sometimes you're not going to
exactly.
Always be ready. And all he did was showed you that if he wanted to, he could control the match and any way he wanted. And I thought to myself, okay, lesson learned. Lesson received. And from
yeah,
that point on,
right?
I was always ready to bump no matter what.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, Velvet, this is Dr. John, and I think the British lady is getting ready to speak, so we might have to wrap
okay.
this incredible show up. Would you say goodbye to everybody for us?
Yep, I will do that. Crazy Train, always a pleasure having to speak to you. I hope we stay in touch, and we'd like to bring you back in the near future if you would like to come back and finish stories with us.
Oh, I love it. Thank you for the invite, Sister Susan. I love you. Always good to talk to you. Stro, it was nice to meet you, brother. You stay safe up there in
you
North
too,
Carolina.
Bro.
Oh, well, thank you,
Velvet,
sir. We will get.
I tell you,
we'll
we've
catch
had,
up
we've
with
had
you
a great show.
Time. Yeah.
And,
yes, we have. It was great.
And thank you for everything. Best of luck tomorrow. And I do want to promote the one and only Carolina Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame first weekend, first Saturday in April. And we'll be inducting the likes of Susan Green, Papa Stro Maestro, Tony Rose, Tommy Wildfire Rich. And Tommy Wildfire Rich will be on our show next week. And
awesome.
Susan Green will be one of our co-hosts because I said, Tommy, do you know Susan Green? He said, oh Lord, yes, I want to talk to her. So Susan, your buddy Tommy Wildfire Rich is looking forward to talking to you next week.
Yeah, we got a few road stories.
I'll get you. I wanted to say thank you to everybody. We're so glad to have you on Pro Wrestling Interviews.
Yeah, thank
you
all,
and,
guys. Everybody be safe
next week.
And love everybody.
Yeah.
All right.
Have a good
all.
Week,
take
guys.
Care.
Yep.
Thank
yep.
you all.
Yep. We'll talk to everybody soon. Take care.
Okay.
Love you all. Bye.
Bye.